supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson spoke at the grand opening of the Vox Big Picture High School in North Philadelphia today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The school was shuttered 4 years ago in a wave of district closures. It's now part of the Philadelphia Housing Authority's ambitious revitalization plan for the Sharswood neighborhood. Carson spoke at length about the power of education and his hopes of making public housing
a dynamic place to protect the vulnerable and to empower all of those who want to become self-sufficient.
Now, neither Carson or anyone else made mention of the Trump administration's proposal to cut HUD's budget by 15%. The Philadelphia Housing Authority thinks the new school will inject stability into one of the city's poorest and most crime-ridden communities. WHYY's Aaron Mozell takes us inside the one-of-a-kind school and the neighborhood it may help to transform.
Good morning. Your sister's already here. She beat you here. Good morning. Hey, how are you?
It's the seventh day of the new school year at Vox Big Picture High School, and students seem to be warming to social worker Jody Ehrlich's morning greeting ritual. Some greet him with a handshake. Others smile timidly before heading inside the hulking building on West Master Street.
I think people need to see a happy face in the morning, someone smiling, a greeting, letting you know that we care.
Kids showing up to school is important anywhere, but you could make the argument that it's particularly important at this school. Budget cuts, poor academics, and enrollment combined to close the original Vox High School nearly 4 years ago. The Philadelphia School District doesn't want that to happen again. But there's even more at stake. The Philadelphia Housing Authority bought the old Vox building from the district as part of a $500 million neighborhood transformation plan in the surrounding neighborhood of Sharswood. PHA hopes the school will help usher in the kind of change that lifts up low-income residents while encouraging middle-class families to move here, too. Kelvin Jeremiah is the Housing Authority's president.
And so as we think about building, rebuilding Sharswood, it's important for us to think about it more, in a more holistic way, about the amenities and institutions that we bring to bear in as we transform that community. Educational facility happens to be one of those key elements.
So far, PHA has also seized hundreds of row homes through eminent domain, demolished most of a 50-year-old public housing complex, and has started building new homes in its place, all in the name of laying down the roots for that mixed-income community to bloom over the next decade and beyond. It's the Housing Authority's most ambitious project ever, and there's a lot on the line. Now, a considerable amount of that pressure is on Big Picture Learning, the nonprofit hired to run the new Vox High School.
Today is a very important opportunity for you to show well, to travel tightly as your group, to stick with your advisor, to be polite, responsible, respectful.
Before first period, Principal Gabe Kurlioff stands in the middle of the cafeteria for morning announcements. Later today, students are leaving the building to start exploring internships for next school year. Those internships are a big part of what makes a Big Picture school different from other traditional public schools in the district. Culture is another. The vast majority of Vox's students come from impoverished neighborhoods where violent crime is routine. David Bromley, Big Picture Philadelphia's executive director, says that's why the school puts a big emphasis on teachers forming positive relationships with their students.
It requires an approach, it requires adults in the building who are patient with the kids, who understand where the kids are coming from, who above and all don't react to the kids' behaviors, except holding them accountable, helping them understand their behaviors, helping them understand why they're acting and the choices they could be making.
Imani Denson is one of the school's 126 freshmen, the only students in the building until next year when a new class will also walk the halls. She says Vox Big Picture is nothing like the other public schools she's attended. It's peaceful.
In my other school, it was kids. They didn't really control them, so they was running around, screaming, not doing their work. They wasn't excited about learning, but I was.
So can a new high school help change this neighborhood? Longtime Sharswood resident Norman Scott is sitting on his stoop around the corner from Vox. He says the new high school will need to be filled with students like Amani to be successful.
You need to have good kids that's going to the school to make the school in the neighborhood uplifted. Because if you got bad kids and just going to the school, what's the use of having kids like that in your neighborhood? That's going to bring it down. And then you got crime rate that's going to go up again. Because they're bringing friends from their neighborhood to come to the school to do something to somebody got a beef with.
But Velvet Lewis says a good school with good kids isn't enough to make things better in Sharswood, especially if the definition of better is having a neighborhood with people of all income levels living side by side.
If you look around now, look at the area. What are you offering this area besides the school? That's going to be a tough sell right here.
Lewis says people need more than a promise of a better neighborhood to move to Sharswood. They have to see the big picture is already becoming reality. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's finance chief says the city may be in for some service cuts as it struggles to pay for new municipal labor contracts. WHYY's Dave Davies explains.
An arbitration panel recently gave city police officers a new 3-year contract with raises averaging 3.5% a year. The state board overseeing the city's finances met to approve a change to the city's 5-year plan to pay for that deal. It means wiping out a $200 million labor reserve fund the city had set aside. Oversight board member Alan Kessler says that leaves the city vulnerable to an unexpected downturn or disaster, what he calls the curveballs of local governance.
We always say when you're a mayor, when you're in the city, you can deal with the fastballs. It's the curveballs that you got to be ready for. And with no reserve fund, we have no ability to react to the curveballs.
And there's more. Labor deals are still to come for 2 more city unions. If they get contracts comparable to the police deal, the cost will wipe out the financial cushion built into the city's plan for 4 of the next 5 years. City Finance Director Rob Dubo says he'll be talking to city managers about finding savings, and that could mean service cuts.
I don't think we'll get through the process without some pain. I think there'll be things that we have to do that people will, you know, be unhappy about, but I think that's just kind of the nature of making sure that we're fiscally stable.
Dubo declined to elaborate on what might be ahead. Fred Wright, president of the city's White Collar Union, one of 2 whose deals are yet to come, says if there's a financial problem, it's because past mayors failed to manage city finances, especially the pension fund.
Listen, we should not take less because, again, we didn't create the problem, nor should we be threatened with layoffs, nor should the public be threatened with service cuts.
Wright's union is negotiating with the city now. The other contract on the way with city firefighters will be decided by an arbitration panel. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Dozens of state attorneys general announced this summer that they'd be going after one of the main drug pipelines supplying the opioid crisis, pharmaceutical companies. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that today, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro named the companies currently in their sights.
Standing on the turf of Upper Dublin High School's football field, Shapiro drew the connection between sports injuries and opioid addiction by talking about families he's met recently.
Candy and Tad Decker of Montgomery County, whose son John was a star lacrosse player at a prep school on the main line, who was prescribed OxyContin after his lacrosse injury. Passed away at 30 of a heroin overdose.
But the sports field was merely a backdrop for an investigation that's been going on behind the scenes. In June, 41 attorneys general joined together to look at whether drug companies are breaking the law and how they present and sell opioid painkillers. On Tuesday, Shapiro shared more about exactly what they're digging into.
The development of the opioid drugs, communications with physicians and consumers, and internal discussions about legal compliance.
And he named 8 companies currently under investigation, some including manufacturers Teva and Endo Pharmaceuticals and the distributor AmerisourceBergen have corporate offices in the Philadelphia area. A spokeswoman for that distributor says they, quote, welcome the opportunity to educate the Attorney General Coalition on our role in the healthcare supply chain. It's not yet clear if the investigation will lead to legal action, although some states have already sued drug manufacturers, alleging misleading marketing. When Shapiro opened his mic to the public, carpenter Benji Eisenstein approached, waving a snapshot of his daughter.
I have 13 and a half years in recovery, not a drinker or a drug. Yeah, I couldn't save my daughter Christmas Day. She died of an overdose.
I asked him afterwards what he thought about going after drug companies. He said there's a lot of blame to go around, but none of it will bring his daughter back. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
There's a new plan in Washington to topple the Affordable Care Act, and that could complicate the life of New Jersey U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. The Democrat is currently on trial for corruption, and he may have to choose between voting on the bill or showing up in court. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Washington, D.C. or Newark, New Jersey? That is the question. If Senate Republicans' latest attempt to replace Obamacare goes up for a vote on a day when witnesses are testifying in his case, Menendez will have to choose where he goes, court or the Capitol. The federal judge in his case already told Menendez that he won't adjourn the trial so the Democrat can travel to D.C. for a Senate vote. Rutgers University political science professor Ross Baker says the political cost to Menendez could be huge if the bill passes, and he was a couple hundred miles away. Menendez is up for re-election next year.
If he's acquitted, he's going to have enough to deal with in his re-election without having to defend his absence from a critical vote on Obamacare.
For the last couple days, Menendez has been tweeting his staunch opposition to the bill. But not appearing in court for your own trial can have consequences too, says Daniel Filler. He's dean of Drexel University's Klein School of Law.
Jurors think that a trial is the most important thing happening in any defendant's life. And a juror's going to wonder why the defendant isn't present.
Filler says it's helpful for defendants to be in court during witness testimony so they can tell their attorney if they hear anything that's incorrect. But the bigger concern, he says, is what's left up to the jury's imagination.
Because jurors will fill in the blank with all kinds of ideas, almost all of which are negative in some way.
Filler says it's unlikely that one day away would tank a defendant's case, but he also cautioned against predicting what's in the minds of those 12 jurors. A spokesman for Menendez says the senator will decide on a case-by-case basis whether to skip court to be in Washington. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Hurricane Maria is barreling toward the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico as a potentially catastrophic Category 5 storm. This as cleanup continues from extensive damage from Harvey and Irma. Joining me to make sense of the spate of strong storms is Dr. Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Dr. Trenberth, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
You're welcome.
These storms and their effects have certainly dominated the news of late, and there's this perception that the cluster is more pervasive and stronger than in previous years. How do we find out if that's the truth?
Well, that's certainly true for the case of the Atlantic. You know, last year had quite a bit of activity late in the year, especially with Hurricane Matthew that caused a tremendous amount of trouble from Florida and Georgia and the Carolinas and record rainfalls and quite a lot of damage. And earlier last year, in August of last year, there was a big flooding event in Louisiana, which was a tropical storm that didn't even have a name. But this year has certainly rebounded to be a very active year, comparable to some of the previous active years in, say, 2010 or 2005. 2005 was the year of Katrina.
We're hearing terms bandied about like storm of the century, though we're hearing them with a frequency that suggests that they're happening more frequently than once 100 years.
Well, you know, the most active year on record globally is 2015, and that was the big El Nino year. It was exceptionally warm out in the Pacific. There were all kinds of records broken with major Category 5 storms, and so we're seeing more intense activity in hurricanes, typhoons, and related things around the world. And this raises the question about climate change, and indeed, the environment is more favorable as a result of climate change.
Dr. Trenberth, President Donald Trump neglected to mention climate change during his address before the United Nations today. Of course, he's previously asserted that the United States will pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. Now, that puts him at odds with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who says, quote, "the science is unassailable." Dr. Trenberth, in your estimation, is the science unassailable?
In terms of global warming happening, yes. In terms of the ocean warming, absolutely. and the environment above the ocean is simply different than it used to be. We've got other records. Hurricanes have a lot of variability from one year to the next. There's a bit of competition between the Pacific versus the Atlantic as to where stuff happens. The best records we have are for heavy rains. And we can go back well over 100 years for heavy rains. And across the United States, when it rains, it simply rains harder than it used to now. So there's excellent records of that. That's very much in keeping with our understanding of the nature of climate change and the fact that there's more moisture in the atmosphere to get caught up in these storms.
Do scientists disagree over the extent to which climate change is responsible for storms like Harvey? And could Harvey have happened even if there was no climate change?
Climate change doesn't cause these storms to happen. But once you've got a Harvey, then the climate change, the fact that the Western Gulf was at record high temperatures, surface temperatures and subsurface temperatures, there was a tremendous amount of fuel available for Harvey, and it makes it a bit bigger and longer lasting. And once, normally when these storms make landfall, they peter out within a day. And Harvey kept going because it was big enough that it could reach out to the Gulf, and there were these spiral arm bands of moisture from the Gulf flowing over Houston, dropping tremendous amounts of rain and continuing to fuel Harvey long after a smaller storm would have petered out. And so that's where the climate change aspects come in. It's the same thing with Irma, that the storm was so big that it went up both sides of Florida, an unprecedented storm in that regard. And so the lifetime and the size of these storms, as well as the intensity of these storms, is what changes. It's not the fact that we have the storms in the first place.
Dr. Tremberth, thanks so much for joining us to lend insight into all the variables that are causing these storms.
Well, climate change is with us, and then the question is, what do we do about it? Do we plan for it? And I think there's not enough planning going on.
Dr. Kevin Tremberth, senior scientist at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. Filmmaker Ken Burns has turned his lens to Vietnam in a documentary currently airing on WHYY-TV. It's the latest focus on the lengthy and controversial conflict. But as WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports, there's another effort in the works to better tell the story of Vietnam through an education center in Washington, D.C.
There are 58,000 names etched into a polished black granite wall in Washington, D.C. Since 1982, 3 million annual visitors stop by this simple memorial to Vietnam veterans who lost their lives on the other side of the world. As part of the wall's design, those visitors descend below ground level along the path of the wall. The effect is a sobering experience.
First and foremost, you have to understand that this is not a memorial to the Vietnam War. This is a memorial to the Vietnam veterans. It's never been political. It's never been military. It's about those who answered the call to service and made the ultimate sacrifice to their country.
Jim Knotts leads the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, the group that raised money to build the wall 35 years ago.
The question that I hear all the time about Vietnam is, well, what's next? What's next for the wall? What's next for our Vietnam veterans?
What's next is an education center planned for across the street from the wall near the Lincoln Memorial.
That's where people will really get a better idea of what it means to have 58,000 names on the wall, 58,000 lives cut short, families forever affected. We're going to have educational presentations so you can understand things like, why did our country decide to send troops to Vietnam? What were their motivations for going? What were their motivations for staying? And then eventually, what were their motivations for leaving?
The Education Center will also honor veterans in a way they weren't recognized when they returned from Vietnam. These days, returning troops are celebrated at ceremonies like this one recently in Smyrna that honored Delaware Army National Guard members returning after supporting the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. U.S. Senator from Delaware Tom Carper, who served three tours as a Navy flight officer in Vietnam, was part of the Welcome Home Committee.
When my squadron came back to California, I can assure you the governor wasn't there.
U.S. senators were not there, congressmen, attorney general. We were happy to be home, but I'm not so sure everybody else was.
He's looking forward to seeing how the Education Center will continue to tell the story of the Vietnam veterans he served with.
I think that memorial is just incredibly beautiful and moving. It does tell the story that a lot of people served over there, and a lot of people laid down their lives. I think the idea of having better telling the story would be terrific. I'd love to see that done.
One way that story will be told is through pictures. The Memorial Fund Group is collecting photos of every veteran who's listed on the wall, all 58,000.
You really get a sense that this was a complete life. This was a person with hopes and dreams, with family, with friends, with buddies. They were high school athletes. They were college leaders. They really run the gamut of our society in every facet.
They've collected more than 50,000 photos so far.
We've made great progress. Delaware, actually, we received the last photo for those from Delaware earlier in 2017.
Pictures of Delaware's veterans are all accounted for, but New Jersey and Pennsylvania are still missing photos.
We have 117 that we need from New Jersey and 68 from Pennsylvania.
In addition to the wall, the southern end of the National Mall is already home to some of the most recognizable monuments in the world, spanning from the Lincoln Memorial up the massive reflecting pool to the World War II Memorial and eventually leading to the Washington Monument. Organizers hope the Education Center at the Wall will be a starting point for visitors to the mall.
This is a project that will cost about $130 million, and we've made a great deal of progress, raising just over a third of that at $42 million, but we have a long way to go.
The legislation that approved the Education Center requires organizers to raise the entire $130 million cost of the project before ever starting construction. With about $90 million to go, Jim Knotts isn't sure when they'll be able to start, but it should take about 2 years to complete once ground is broken. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.